Our schedule for the afternoon calls for two presentations, the first of which will begin shortly, after the conclusion of which we will have a brief break and reassemble again for the second presentation. The presentation this afternoon on Luther and Christian education will be presented by Professor James M. Kittleson, professor in the Department of History, Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. Professor Kittleson received his doctorate from Stanford University in 1969. He has been engaged in teaching since 1967. First at the University of Iowa, and then at Ohio State University. He has been the recipient of numerous honors, awards, and offices. I shall only select a few of the many to indicate the nature of the awards. He was a Woodrow Wilson Fellow in 1963 and 1964. For example, also received a fellowship for independent study and research under the National Endowment for the Humanities. His scholarly interests have been primarily centered around southwestern Germany, particularly Strasbourg, and the reformers whose names are associated with that city. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to present and welcome Professor James Kittleson.
Thank you. I noticed a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about this. Will your recorder still work? It's called the creative response. I know it's customary for speakers to say how delighted they are to be present with everyone on occasions such as this. Believe me, that goes in spades for me. I thought about 2 hours ago yesterday that I would instead be recovering from nose surgery, if you can believe it. I thought that was reserved for young ladies. Or particularly ugly young men. But I found a marvelous doctor who was capable of averting that possibility. Then, at 4 o'clock, I came down with this cold. So here I am with cough drops and a handkerchief in one hand and paper in the other. I can't tell you what a relief it is to be here rather than where I could have been. But let's get to work. Little Wittenberg, Luther is reported to have called it. And little it was indeed. New, too. In addition, Luther himself was apparently not much to talk about as he began his career as a professor there. In 1514, one Paul Lange took a tour of German universities to interview, for a book he was writing, both those who were already famous for their learning and those who, so rumor had it, would likely become learned and famous. Isn't it amazing how those who aren't learned and famous like to write about those who are? It may be something of a surprise that he even included Wittenberg in his itinerary. It is certainly at least a curiosity that in so doing he did not interview Martin Luther. In fact, Luther would certainly not have been the historical figure we know if he would have been any historical figure of note at all had he not been mightily concerned with Christian education, or at least with the education of Christians. Moreover, he himself knew just how important education was in his own time. And as a consequence, this assertion is by no means an invention of scholarly hindsight. in 1518, on his way back from the Heidelberg Disputation, where for the first time he put before a large and learned audience the basic outlines of his theology, and scored a smashing success. He wrote one of his colleagues the following: "I sincerely believe that it is impossible for the church to be reformed unless the canon law, the decretals, scholastic philosophy and theology, and logic, as they now exist, are absolutely eradicated and other studies substituted." Nor did he leave the matter to polite private conversation with colleagues. In 1520, he went public in the famous address to the Christian nobility, when he declared, "The universities need a sound and thorough reformation. I must say so no matter who takes offense." 3 years later, he published a treatise in which he argued with typical vigor that all cities should found schools for their children. If, he insisted, and I find this remark has a certain pregnant poignancy, if, he insisted, you must spend one groschen on walls and fortifications, then you must spend 15 on educating one child. In 1530, he added a sermon in which he urged all the temporal authorities to force children to attend school. Martin Luther, the first truant officer. Finally, in one of his last acts, just 2 days before his death, Luther participated in the founding of a Latin school in Eisleben, to which he made a substantial personal financial contribution. Luther took education very seriously. And of course, given the context of the times, it was by definition Christian education. Now, all the foregoing is so well known, at least to specialists, that it has required the 500th anniversary of his birth, in conjunction, I think, with genuine concerns about education in this country, to rekindle interest in the subject. Indeed, there can be little surprise in hearing that Luther should be mightily concerned with the status of education in his own time. He was, after all, a professor who made his living as an educator. Yet, three tricky problems confront us right at the outset. In the first place, the term education, to say nothing of the term Christian education in the second half of the 20th century, is a very slippery one. What is being taught? How is it being taught? And what is the desired outcome are just three questions that need clear answers. Secondly, for all of his interest in the subject, Luther was not the primary creator of curricular changes, and in particular, not at the lower levels. For the most part, this work was left to individuals like his colleague Philip Melanchthon, who was much more securely grounded than he in the educational programs of Renaissance humanism. Finally, and to complicate matters much more, education at all levels was a subject of intense debate just before and during the early years of the Reformation. Before even proceeding with the discussion, it is therefore very important to clear away an enormous underbrush of possibly misleading preconceptions. To confuse matters even more, I'm going to proceed with these issues in reverse order. First, the Renaissance debate over education. Briefly, the humanist critique of education in their own time centered on one charge, namely, that propositional knowledge, as taught by the schoolmen, was of a sort that bore no fruit in daily life, and therefore detracted from the proper educational enterprise. Thus, for logic or dialectic, a cornerstone of scholasticism, They would substitute rhetoric, grammar, and the ancient languages. In religion, the search for doctrinal truth was to be replaced by poetry and history to the end of gaining enlightened piety. If Aristotle, the father of them that know, was not to be removed entirely from the curriculum, then only his rhetoric and poetics were to be read. For the humanists, thus, true knowledge was not universal and propositional, but concrete and specific to time and place. Its fruits were not scientia, science, but sapientia, wisdom. And wisdom was to be found in the marketplace and the conduct of daily life, rather than in the classroom. Education thus had an end, both temporally and finally. The end was the finished person who came out of the classroom and into society, who, in the words of the great Florentine Leonardo Bruni, was studying without appearing to be studious. I want to elaborate just for a moment, give one example as to how this could affect a specific field of inquiry. Intentionally, I choose not theology, but law. And here we find the humanists mightily attracted to the doctrine of epieikeia, or equity in enforcing the law, and the corresponding notion that the full force of the law produces the greatest injury. Now, simply put, the idea is that individual cases should be adjudicated according to the spirit or intent of the law rather than according to its character, its letter. Thus, any law that could be expressed abstractly abruptly lost its universal character, at least in the sense that it no longer applied to specific cases in anything like the way a cookie cutter may be applied to cookie dough. Circumstances always had to be taken into account. Thus, for the humanists, the endless academic debate in search of pure justice was irrelevant because it had no application, and if applied, tended to produce inequity. Now, all of this may sound very far afield from the subject, but it is not. And so we proceed backwards to the second preliminary point. Luther was a recipient of this humanist educational critique. In fact, in many respects, he and the movement that flowed from him did the one thing that the Renaissance humanists never could accomplish. He institutionalized their educational ideals in both lower schools and universities, and he did so in three ways. First, he personally was at the forefront of a movement to reform his own university, such that by 1523, all the proposals that he had spelled out in private correspondence in 1518 and in the address of 1520 were in place. These reforms then spread to other universities in Lutheran lands, both old and new, Tübingen, Marburg, Strasbourg, for example. And as already indicated, he also aided the founding of primary schools. Secondly, the reform movement provided the crucially important financial resources to accomplish these goals. The current dictum, "there ain't no such thing as a free lunch," applied in the 16th century with just as much force as it does today. And the reformers did something about it. In brief, they persuaded the secular authorities to take the income that had supported convents, monasteries, and the like, and to turn it into resources for schools. Finally, as already noted, Luther provided leadership for the educational movement. Interestingly, the 1524 address to the municipalities, in which he urged the founding of schools, was substantially repeated in an appeal by Strasbourg's reformers to their magistrates in August of the same year, and then reiterated at some length in the preface to a Hebrew grammar published by one of their number in 1525. At this point, however, a problem arose for them, and therefore for us. To explain requires a closer look at the educational writings themselves. As indicated, Luther was the recipient of the humanist educational program. And if you look at the address to the Christian nobility of 1520, it's all laid out there very clearly. But he was also a late medieval professor, as well as an evangelical reformer for whom the learning and teaching of true doctrine, that is to say, universal propositions, were essential. Surely this is the meaning of his thunderous reply to Erasmus in the debate on the freedom of the will. Spiritus Sanctus non scepticus est. The Holy Spirit is not a skeptic. The problem to which I allude is that the Renaissance ideal of the enlightened Christian citizen and the Reformation ideal of teaching true doctrine coexisted in the minds of Luther and others. And in many respects, they were conflicting. I think there are frequently echoes of that debate today in Lutheran colleges and universities. But they are both present in Luther's principal writings. I've already referred to the address of the Christian nobility. One of the interesting things about that is he simply refers there to the Bible without making specific doctrinal statements. And yet, when Luther declared that the Bible should be the core of the theological curriculum, he did so on the assumption that the scriptures were clear and simple, and that they pointed to Christ alone. Here, Luther most definitely did not have in mind simply the acquisition of biblical knowledge, but also the sound doctrine upon which the Reformation was based from the very first. In his works in the lower schools, he also made it clear that they had two purposes, both to create a generally educated citizenry and to teach true doctrine. In fact, I think it is possible that he became even more pronounced in his views on the dual nature of education as the years passed. Here, I think his actions spoke more loudly than his words. Luther's sole contribution to the curriculum of what we call primary schools was, after all, his catechisms. And what are they, if not doctrine, at the most popular level? Moreover, next to the Bible, or portions thereof, his small catechism was in fact used in the schools to teach both reading and sound doctrine at the same time. This use of the catechism contains a fine irony with respect to the question of Luther's relationship to Renaissance pedagogy. While Erasmus collected his adages and sayings from the ancient authors so that students might acquire both piety and good Latin while copying them, Luther did the same with his catechisms, but for piety, he substituted true doctrine of a universal, timeless kind. Now, at this juncture, a question naturally poses itself. Did this conflict between wisdom and doctrine, which I am alleging existed in principle, exist in fact? Or is it merely the product of an overly clever historian who is blessed with too much hindsight? No, it did exist on at least two occasions. In Basel in the 1530s, and later at Strasbourg in the 1570s. To take Basel first. Here the issue took the form of a struggle between church and university. First, over how much educational attainment should be expected of pastors, and secondly, over whether the university should control the church, or the other way around. The person of interest in these two controversies is one Wolfgang Capito. He's the Strasbourg reformer, whose Hebrew grammar was referred to earlier, and a person who had strong ties to Basel. With regard to the first issue, he squarely backed education for pastors of a humanistic kind, declaring, "What harm is it to a pastor that he is a member of the Society of the Learned and the Learning? We absolutely require everything that we have been taught." But then he added that the granting of degrees in theology, that is to say, the training of pastors, and what he called the governance of the church, should be bound together and should not be torn apart from one another. If they were divided, he argued, and I see a certain prescience there, especially being from the Ohio State University, if they were divided, quote, "the university will become heathen and stand in eternal enmity to the churches with unquestionable evil consequences for the churches." Theology or religious knowledge was thus not just a matter of learning, and it could not be left simply to the universities. The issue came to an even more sharply focused controversy in Strasbourg itself a generation later. Suffice to say, the city was in a very peculiar situation, in which it had both an academy, headed by one Johann Sturm, perhaps the most famous humanist educator of the time, who really had implemented Erasmus' program, and on the other hand, what was called the Preacher's College, and people giving theological lectures. Some of the pastors were thus professors in the academy, and the candidates for ministry were also members of the academy as students. The question is, who controls the education and lives of these candidates for the ministry who are in both institutions? We have here a situation in which a conflict in ideals produced overlapping institutional structures. And it burst into controversy in the 1570s and later. The humanist rector of the academy, Sturm, had as his target the Preacher's College. Indeed, the heart of his reform proposal was that it, quote, should be subject to the academic assembly, for it is from these two colleges that barbarism insinuates itself, into our school. The plan of study he proposed for the Preacher's College was in fact so weighted toward the typical humanist curriculum that it included Luther's catechism only in the 8th and 9th forms, that is to say, at the very beginning. In just this regard, Sturm's reasoning and his complaint is, I think, most revealing. He says, "For we other professors," to the non-theologians, "we other professors are excluded and cast out of their theologians' assembly and are considered by them to be such unlearned people who know nothing about the business and so inept and incomprehending that we do not understand such matters and cannot judge and consider them." Here was the standard humanist complaint about academic theologians, complete with charges of barbarism. Later on, a Tübingen theologian entered the fray and put the opposite side's point of view just as clearly. "Sturm," he said, "was perfectly qualified to study the orations of Cicero, Demosthenes, and Quintilian, and to explain the writings of Homer. But in seeking also to judge true doctrine, he was exceeding his grasp with his reach. To explicate religious controversies reliably and to interpret sacred letters does not belong to all people." This was the work of professionals. So, there was a genuine, albeit usually latent, conflict between the humanist's pursuit of wisdom and the reformer's drive to true doctrine, however much they may have agreed about what constituted proper preparatory studies. It must be added, by the way, that for the most part, the two continued to coexist fairly comfortably in Luther's universities. German high culture did become overwhelmingly humanistic, even in the midst of the doctrinal wars that forged Lutheran orthodoxy during the second half of the 16th century. But there is something far more important than all of these preliminaries. And so I lay before you the following thesis. You know a professor is serious when he starts talking about laying theses forward. Namely, that this alliance between humanism and evangelical religion, however uneasy at times, was an extraordinarily productive one, because from it came the fundamentally modern notion that even at the most popular levels, true religion is at least as much a matter of the head as of the heart and of behavior. Now, it must be confessed at the outset that from Christianity's very beginnings, there has been something of a tension between religion of the heart and religion of the mind. But generally, as with Origen or Augustine, for example, it was thought that this was a distinction of importance only to intellectuals. Origen, in fact, distinguished between the religion that was sufficient for the simple and the mysteries that were available to the learned. And Augustine's own pilgrimage was a profoundly intellectual one. It may even be argued that the exhortation common to the late Middle Ages, to do what is within you to earn your salvation, was a theological formulation by the learned for the simple. In sum, the idea that religion could be a matter of knowledge was reserved to the learned. Let me get some water. Luther and the Reformation changed this situation dramatically. Naturally enough, it did so first with the clergy. One of the most common complaints about the pre-Reformation priest was that he was an ignorant lout, little different from the rude peasants he served. Most recent research suggests that this is probably true. But by the end of the 16th century, a very different situation prevailed. To take a few examples, in one territory, the percentage of university-educated clergy rose from 22.5 in 1560 to 78.1 in 1619. In Zweibrücken, the figures are 33.3 and 92%, and so forth and so on. Even in the city of Strasbourg, we have, during a 23-year period at the end of the century, a total of 132 persons nominated for parish posts. Of these, 97, or 73.5%, held the Master of Arts degree as well as certification for ordination. It is true, as one scholar recently put it, that Lutheran pastors became intellectuals close to the people. Moreover, these pastors conducted their ministries in many respects as an educational program, even if local schools were unavailable, as they were in many rural areas. I've already mentioned the catechisms. It must be added that catechetical instruction remained one of the very first tasks of these pastors, at least if they wished to remain pastors very long. How'd you like that in your parish? Huh? With surprising frequency, they could, in fact, recite it. Again, however, and it should be obvious, it was not just education in general that was sought. The main point was and remained true doctrine, as the role of the catechism well indicates. There are also indications that the leaders of the church took Luther's doctrinal concerns very seriously in other respects. One verse of a common canticle sung in the Palatinate at the end of the century makes the point clearly. It is verse 16, and it is dedicated to the pastors. It reads, "God give us grace and strength that we may earnestly teach the faith, ward off false teachings in life, and further God's word and work." Another example of doctrine at the parish level is number 297 in the Lutheran Book of Worship, written by Paul Speratus, who died in 1551. The first two stanzas summarize Luther's teachings with remarkable faithfulness. Listen to this. "Salvation unto us is come by God's free grace and favor. Good works cannot avert our doom, they help and save us never. Faith looks to Jesus Christ alone, who did for all the world atone. He is our mediator. Theirs was a false, misleading dream, who thought God's law was given that sinners might themselves redeem and by their works gain heaven. The law is but a mirror bright to bring the inbred sin to light that lurks within our nature." I know one should never read the Lutheran hymn and stop at the second verse, but I'm going to. To make the point, here is pure Luther, even to his understanding of the Christocentric nature of the law. Very sophisticated theological point, right there in a hymn. Now, all of this is by no means to argue that their humanistic educations disappeared as these clerical and lay leaders took up their adult careers. At the end of the century, one pastor wrote a few lines about himself that may well have applied to most Lutheran pastors. He said, tell me if you hear Mephistopheles' first speech in Goethe's Faust in this. I find it reminiscent. "I have learned strict logic thoroughly and read the thick books of rhetoric. I have become acquainted with the spheres of the heavens, with what physics does for me, what ethics brings forth from morals, and even to cut out the rhythm of Homer." Yeah, and then Mephistopheles says, "And here I stand, no smarter than I was before." Not so this Lutheran pastor. He knew, because then we go into the true doctrine part. So, humanism remained conjoined to the Reformation, just as it had been in Luther's own mind and with remarkable faithfulness. But it must be added, the humanist ideal endured in no manner that a Petrarch, an Erasmus, or a Johann Sturm would have approved. It remained as a method. This can be seen very clearly in the manner these pastors and their parishioners were taught the new faith. Indeed, it can be said with a great deal of truth that without the humanist educational program, and one of them in particular, the very emphasis upon doctrine that so characterized the Reformation at the most popular levels would be inconceivable. Now, we have to back up one moment. No matter what Luther said about it, the Reformation did not happen because the word brought down the papacy while he and Melanchthon sat in his garden drinking beer. At least not evidently so. Such was Luther's fond hope, certainly. But between 1527 and 1529, he and his colleagues received a direct and very rude awakening. These were the years that the Lutheran princes sent out visitors into their territories to determine the status of the local parishes. After hearing the first results, Luther wrote one of his friends, "What miseries we see here." It was not just that priests had left their parishes. The donors to the work of the church had reclaimed their property. Or even that the German peasant appeared to have the sexual mores of a herd of rabbits. What Luther saw was religious ignorance. After serving as a visitor himself, he wrote another friend, I have turned to the means by which a catechism may be prepared for the raw pagans. Now, I just play with one word here. He didn't need to use the word paganis. He could have used the word rusticis. And this word rusticis roughly means hayseeds. No, he chose the word paganis, which by the 16th century has the connotation pagan. Put that in the connotation, in the connection, in the context, with his decision to write catechisms. And I think it's clear that for Luther, to be a pagan was to be unaware of true doctrine. Pagan remaining, by the way, a cultural term. As a result of the visitations, therefore, the fond hope that just preaching at the Castle Church in Wittenberg or lecturing at the university would accomplish the Reformation suddenly vanished. Something had to be done. But what? The catechisms were one thing, but it was also necessary to find people to teach the catechism. An entirely new clergy had to be created. Here, Luther and his colleagues made a critical decision. They decided, it would appear, to accelerate what they had already been doing, namely using Lutheran universities to train new Lutheran pastors. In fact, Luther's own correspondence during this period is filled with reference letters for placing this student or that student in a particular post and letters of encouragement for those already placed. Luther and Melanchthon also continued to use humanistic methods, and this one in particular, to accomplish this task. The result was that humanistic methods curiously reinforced the tendency to equate true religion with true doctrine. Now, to explain what happened requires a very brief side trip into the history of biblical studies. It is well known to everyone except one of the speakers at a conference I was at last week. He was disciplined. It is well known that for Luther, the scriptures were authoritative because they contained Christ and him crucified, both the Old Testament and the New. In the Old, Luther found not so much concrete predictions of Christ's coming, although he found that too, as a dramatic foreshadowing of God's gracious work with his people. In the New Testament, the work of salvation was then completed in the life, death, and resurrection of Christ. Because, maintained Luther, Christ was the central point of view of the authors of the scriptures, Christ was therefore also the canon of the scriptures and the content of all proper exegesis. So, for sola fide, sola gratia, sola scriptura, etc., etc., we substitute solo Christo. In this way, the content of the scriptures became the verbum promae, the living, saving word, at least when preached. The authority of the scriptures derived, therefore, from Christ and did not exist apart from Christ. Now, specific doctrines, of course, flowed from this fundamental position. But here the Reformers faced a problem, and I ask you to think your way back into their situation in 1527, 28, and 29. How were they to communicate this evangelical understanding of the gospel to as many of the candidates for the ministry as possible, as accurately as possible, and as quickly as possible? Here was where Melanchthon, with Luther's hearty concurrence, entered the picture. He decided to employ what has been called the Lotzi method. And believe me, it was the most up-to-date thing in Kansas City at the time. The Lotzi, or topoi method, is borrowed from classical rhetoric. According to it, in any particular subject, be it astronomy, medicine, law, theology, you name it, certain topics or commonplaces exist that must be treated if a treatise or lecture on the subject is to be successful. Another way to understand the topics or commonplaces is to call them the issues essential to the subject under discussion. They arise out of the subject matter rather than are being imposed upon it. Thus, Melanchthon, in 1521, publishes Loci Communes, or Commonplaces of Evangelical Theology, in an attempt to communicate Luther's evangelical religion efficiently and accurately to a broad range of scholars. And many others did the same thing throughout the course of the century, no matter of what religious persuasion. Now, the Loci Communes were, of course, books of Christian doctrine, just as were the catechisms. But they were not intended for the classroom. We have to go back to base one now. After all, Luther had laid down quite clearly, and Melanchthon concurred, that books other than the Bible, quote, should be read for a little while only, and in order that they might lead us to the Bible. In fact, textbooks or theological commonplaces were not introduced into Lutheran theological classrooms until the late 16th and early 17th century. The Bible remained, as Luther wished it to be, the core of the curriculum, namely the substance of it. Therefore, in the classroom, evangelical theology must be communicated through scriptural exegesis. That's the way you have to do it. Here, the Loci method was used again through an interesting syllogism that I think is just terribly apparent, but I'm terribly proud of myself for having discovered it. Point one, the scriptures are authoritative in all matters essential to salvation. Right?
Right.
Point two, any book that successfully teaches its subject covers all the loci or topoi or topics in the subject. Point three, therefore, with irrefutable logic, the books of the Bible must each speak clearly to all the topics or commonplaces of evangelical theology. Fight about that syllogism later. Consequently, as a matter of method for teaching, the professor was obligated to lay out for his students what each book of the Bible pronounced with respect to each of the basic evangelical doctrines. Certainly, the exegete would employ the ancient languages, history, and grammar to understand and communicate the vitality of the text, but it was certain that the text spoke to the principal theological concerns of the time. That had to be the case. Through adopting this basically humanistic educational method, Melanchthon and many other loyal followers of Luther thus introduced a subtle shift in the evangelical understanding of the content of the scriptures. No longer did they contain just Christ and Him crucified. They also contained all the doctrines that were necessary for salvation. The Bible became, therefore, also a book of doctrines. In this way, the Reformers' use of humanistic educational tools for evangelical purposes powerfully encouraged the tendency to equate true religion with true doctrine, even at the most popular level. And a certain intellectualization of religion naturally followed. But is it the case with Luther as it was with Marx, who said on his deathbed, "I am not a Marxist"? Did Luther really believe that true doctrine equaled true religion? No, he was much too much the pastor to believe such an absurdity. But the matter is more complicated than such a quick answer might suggest. I think his description of an ideal pastor is appropriate here. First, a good preacher should be able to teach well, correctly, and in an orderly fashion. Secondly, he should have a good head on his shoulders. Thirdly, he should be eloquent. Fourthly, he should have a good voice. Fifthly, he should have a good memory. Sixthly, he should know when to stop. Seventhly, he should be constant and diligent about his affairs. Eighthly, he should invest body and life, possessions and honor in it. Ninthly, he should be willing to let everyone vex and hack away at him. Now, there are 9 items on this list, but the first 6 are intellectual rather than moral or affective virtues in the sense that they could be taught. And there can be no doubt, then, that Luther, the educational reformer, contributed to the modern world, not only by insisting that basic education be available to all, but also by bringing to the common herd the notion that true religion could be a matter of the mind as well as of the heart and of behavior. That the laity could argue with the pastor on matters of doctrine, I suppose. From the training of pastors, to the catechisms, to the hymns, Luther's educational reforms, in fact, did much to create the modern world with its typical distinction between religion of the head and religion of the heart. There has already been one irony in this story. The irony that the humanists, with their aversion to general propositions and to a religion of doctrines, should have provided the principal methods by which the reformers could create a religion of doctrines and establish an educational system that brought this creation to the common people. But there is a second irony. And here is the critical point, I think, for talking about Luther and Christian education. Luther himself did not distinguish between religion of the heart and religion of the mind. His preface to the Large Catechism, he declared, "I, a learned doctor, must still read and study the catechism daily. Yet I cannot master it as I wish, even though I wrote it, but must remain a child and pupil of the catechism, and I do it gladly." But Luther thought that in so doing, something spiritual was taking place. Quote, "In such reading, conversation, and meditation, the Holy Spirit is present and bestows ever newer and greater light and fervor, so that day by day we relish and appreciate the catechism more greatly." No. It was the Enlightenment, and in particular for the Anglo-American tradition, John Locke, who divided the heart from the mind. For Luther, they were one, with each prompting the other. So too was it for the humanist. Yet it must be added that it was Luther, above all, who brought education, even of the most general sort, to the public. It was he too who argued that the average person could know what they believed and could then act upon what they knew. Without this work, whatever our problems may be, we ourselves would be very different people indeed. Thank you.
As I indicated in the beginning, Professor Kittleson has kindly consented to respond to questions or comments in the time that's available before we have our break. So we're open to questions or comments at this time.
No, it does not. For Luther, head and heart were the same thing. And the idea of the two kingdoms does posit something that's truly spiritual. Okay? Is that clear? I said the doctrine of the totus homo, the whole man, is either oriented toward God or toward mammon. I think it's really amusing in contemporary religious circles how often we think that what goes on inside my emotions is spiritual, and what goes on inside my head is carnal. Well, I don't think that's true. Anybody else? Wow.
Thank you very much. We now stand adjourned until 4:15.
Long on both counts. There's a little article I published in the Archive for Reformation History that came out last year about this time that raises some serious questions about how correct he is in his reading of the visitation reports. In some, he claims to have read them for all of Germany and found that people didn't respond. I have read them for the city of Strasbourg, day by day, year to year, parish by parish, which, by the way, is included in his so-called sample. And I think I have proven conclusively that the Reform movement succeeded in certain very concrete ways. Its understanding of Lutheran pedagogy is also wrong. I do not understand how anyone can go to Luther's on the bondage of the will and draw from it conclusions having to do with pedagogy, because Luther wasn't talking about that in the bondage of the will. He was not talking about the improvability of human beings in the here and now. And I hope I've demonstrated today that Luther, in fact, did adopt the humanistic educational program whole cloth. And if there were failures in that, well, and those failures belong to Erasmus and Vitellina da Feltre and some other folks.